You're listening to CGSF 90.1 in Burnaby, British Columbia.
Today on Wings, the topic is economic structural adjustment and its impact on women and their families' lives. Since the 1980s, the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank have lent vast sums of money to the majority of developing countries' governments around the world. The terms of these loans require deep cuts to domestic spending and opening up their territory to foreign ownership, investment, and trade. Women economists from around the world have been speaking critically about this since the 1980s. This documentary was recorded in 1991. The practice continues today.
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service. For the past decade, the United States has been prescribing a bitter medicine for countries that are in debt or that want to develop. The medicine is called structural adjustment, and the theory is that poor nations' resources must be shifted away from social welfare and the public sector and turned over to profit-making private enterprise.
For every dollar which the Jamaican people earn, 50 cents has to be paid back to the World Bank, the International Development Fund for debt servicing, and the International Monetary Fund, who sits over all like God, then tells you how you spend the 50 cents.
Jamaican radio journalist Barbara Glowden at the International Women's Media Foundation conference in November 1990.
We've just spent the past 8 months groveling to the IMF for an agreement signed last week. You know that agreement says that the government shall remove all subsidy from food for the poor. We can go no lower. We need, as women, to understand that there is an imperative which is making women of the world band the belly tighter.
Some analysts conclude that the authors of enforced structural adjustment must realize by now that the changes they impose are not just temporarily painful, but have long-term adverse effects on the future of the poor. This question was taken up at an Association for Women in Development convention on a panel titled The Impact of Structural Adjustment on Women. Peggy Antrobus from Barbados.
I was quite surprised when our moderator said that she attended a World Bank meeting and there was some question as to whether structural adjustment policies have had a negative impact on women. I would like to say that there is plenty of evidence. UNICEF was the first international agency, and I stand subject to correction, to document in some detail, with all the figures that you might want, what was the impact of structural adjustment policies on what they call vulnerable groups, and they talked about women, children, and the elderly. My own quarrel with UNICEF is that I do not wish to put women, children, and the elderly in the same package, because in fact it is women who are bearing the burden of that, since women have to look after children and the elderly. Lest anybody should be in any doubt as to where I stand on structural adjustment, I am totally against it. People can get into all sorts of debates. Yes, there's need for adjustment, but maybe it could be modified. So I want to be very clear and very specific. In the Caribbean, the term structural adjustment means a particular and specific package of policies, which include concentration on export production, cuts in social services, continuing devaluation of the currency, the liberalization of imports, and the removal of food subsidies and price controls on many consumer goods. Now, economists here will immediately recognize some contradictions. Because on the one hand, you're supposed to open up your markets, and on the other hand, you're supposed to increase your exports. And I'm not quite sure how you maintain any kind of balance if you're doing these two contradictory things. These policies were first introduced, at least officially in the Caribbean, in 1984 in a document known as the Nassau Understanding. This was a document that came out of a meeting of Caribbean heads of governments. And when I talk about the Caribbean, I'm afraid I'm talking about the English-speaking Caribbean. And these policies, I think at the time, people didn't pay much attention to them. I think we didn't really understand what they meant. In my own case, it was only my association with the Dawn Group, the group Development Alternatives with Women for a New Era, and in particular Geeta Sen, who is standing there, who alerted me to what these policies actually meant. And I remember going back to the Caribbean after a meeting of Dawn in the beginning of 1985 and talking about the linkages between these economic policies and the social and political consequences. And we've seen those things just played out in the Caribbean. It's almost as if somebody gave us a script in 1985 and everything in that script is taking place in the Caribbean to greater or lesser degree. It started with the government of Jamaica, and they had the most complete implementation of those policies. Severe cuts in social services between the years 1981 and 82, and 85 and 86, which was the period during which these policies were really going full blast. Cuts in social services of the order of 44%. Not only cuts in social services, but increases in the price charges for services that had been formerly free, in hospital, medicines, for the poor. How can you expect countries where the majority of people are poor to be adopting policies that are even inappropriate for countries where there's a minority of poor? And it's this attempt to introduce these policies broad scale, across the board, regardless of what is the level of development, what are the characteristics of the country, that one of the reasons why I have such a strong stand against them. But then other governments followed, and I want to draw attention to the fact that it's not even those governments with a debt. The government of a small country like St. Vincent, which had no debt, was also introducing those policies. In fact, the name of the game in development circles today is structural adjustment. Structural adjustment has become almost an alternative way of talking about development. And certainly many of our government's development plans are completely focused on this. And there are all sorts of carrot and stick mechanisms for getting governments to adopt these policies, which I don't need to go into here. To get back to the actual experience of the Caribbean, when these policies were first introduced, I thought, well, here are a set of policies that reflect a failure to take gender into account. Now, as I think more about these policies, I think they actually reflect a gender ideology, a set of assumptions about women, which say that women's time can be exploited, women's labor can be exploited, and you can cut services in these so-called non-productive sectors and concentrate on your exports because women are there to fill those gaps. And indeed, I want to draw attention to the fact, particularly for those of us who've worked throughout the decade, to draw attention to women's contribution, to the value of women's contribution. But in fact, it is knowledge and understanding of women's contribution that is quite often used to justify making those cuts. When you cut social services, you jeopardize women in three ways. First of all, you cut women's access to jobs, because most of the jobs that are cut in the social sector, anyway in the Caribbean, are jobs held by women. Teachers, nurses, people in the government services. Secondly, you cut women's access to services that are essential for women who are working in the formal sector of the economy. It's the women who use those services. And finally, of course, women are expected to fill the gaps. So you squeeze women, and then you say, now, here is the additional burden. I want to turn now to the question of the export promotion. In the Caribbean, these are focused on the model of free trade zones. Again, in Jamaica, the experience of women in the garment industry has been devastating. And I needn't say more about that. I'm sure everybody here understands it. The point that I'm trying to make is that those policies, the encouragement of foreign investment, is also based on a gender ideology that says that you can exploit women's labor. In other words, they depend on the existence of a large, cheap, female labor force. I want to close by drawing attention to the fact that we have to pay more attention to strategic gender interests and needs. In other words, to giving women the power to set some of those agendas, to make the demands, to advocate and to resist these policies. And that what the experience of the 80s has shown is that if you don't pay attention to those strategic needs, to enabling women to be advocates and to resist those policies, then even the practical gains of the 70s are very easily reversed. And finally, to those people who say you can concentrate on economic production and ignore that social sector, I want to point out that, to my mind, production is not just a function of markets and technology and capital. It's also a function of the psychological, the physical, and the intellectual capacities of people, of the labor force. And that these physical, psychological, and intellectual capacities are determined in that very social sector. So that if you squeeze the social sector, if you make those cuts, then you are jeopardizing the long-term growth that you say you're trying to achieve. Thank you.
The next speaker was Elizabeth Luwanga Okwenji, African Region Director of Oxfam America.
In a small West African country, 55-year-old Fatmata sits outside her house. She looks up to the skies and asks her gods, what is the world coming to? She has this growing pain in her body. It's both physical, it is mental, and she seems to be forever tired, worried, and many times actually quite frightened. Nothing is right anymore. Fatmata cannot exactly tell when all of this started, but she remembers that it was somehow related to the harvest of 1986, when Momodu, her husband, told her and her two co-wives that if he had only grown more groundnuts, he would be rich. He had announced then that for the next season, he needed more land for growing groundnuts. And that not only that, his three wives were to spend more time helping him in the field to grow the groundnuts. Because he says he had been told that groundnuts were going to fetch a higher price. It was also about the same time that Fatmata's son, Jibril, who worked out in the city and had worked all of his adult life as a government driver, came home and announced that he had been laid off from his government service. He had explained that the government was broke and that it had had, therefore, to lay off quite a number of its employees. Of Jibril had been so miserable. For several months, Fatmata had had to send grain, dry fish, and any other food items that she could lay her hands on to the city, to her son, because he had refused to come home to help them in the field, for he had always lived in the city. His wife and children were used to a city life. So she had had to send him food for him to survive whenever she found somebody going to the city. The following planting season had been extremely exhausting. All that Momodu, their husband, had ever wanted to hear about were the groundnuts. More time for the groundnuts, more land for the groundnuts. In the end, she and her co-wives had had to abandon their vegetable gardens and even plant less of the maize and the millet. Her co-wives had also had to abandon their women's clubs activities because there just wasn't time to do anything else but worry about the groundnuts. Whether Momodu made any money out of those groundnuts or not, his wives never really knew. The only sign of his having had more money was that he married his fourth wife. Fatmata continues to wonder why nothing seems to be available anymore. Recently, her grandchild had been taken to the clinic in the next village, and the nurse in the clinic had told them that she had no medicines and that for several months now she had been waiting for supplies to come in from the city. She had gone on, in fact, to explain to them that even the doctor that always came around once a month hadn't been to the clinic in several months. It had only been by the grace of God that the herbs that Fatmata mixed for her grandchild took away the fever. The classes for reading and writing, which her co-wives had been attending, had also stopped some months back. Even some teachers at the primary school had been laid off. In fact, there was general fear in the village that the school might actually be closed. But what worried Fatmata most was how they were going to feed their large family. The grain they had produced was less. The little income that they often generated from the sale of surplus maize and millet and from the vegetables was not there anymore. The grain was almost gone, and there were still 6 months to go before the next planting season. Recently, Jibril, her son in the city, had come by and brought his two teenage sons and left them with her because his wife had left him and he couldn't take care of them. She must think of something to do to bring in some money quickly. Perhaps she'll try some fish smoking and get the children to sell the fish. She must do something fast. but she wishes that that pain would only go away. As Fatoumata peruses over her problems, another woman, much younger, in her mid-30s, very well educated, holding a very senior civil service job in a Southern African country, is also asking the same question. What is the world coming to? Mwila, who is an assistant secretary in the Ministry of Social Services, was having very serious family problems. The problems had started about the same time that the government had announced removal of subsidies on meal meal, which is the staple food, and the food riots that had followed at that time. Her husband, Jack, who held a senior job with a mining company, had at that time been persuaded to take advantage of the move to privatization and had quit his job and gone into business with some foreign businessmen doing import and export. Mwila, her husband, and their four children moved to the city, to the capital city, where her husband's new job was. They took out a mortgage on a four-bedroomed house in a beautiful part of the city. While Jack was struggling to get his new venture going, Mwila was forced to support the family on her equivalent of $200 a month. But it happened that it was also the time when the price of all available commodities were completely out of control. Worse still, Mwila had to spend hours looking for soap, toothpaste, sugar, oil, even milk for her children. And a time came that even when she found these commodities, she just simply couldn't afford to pay for them. In order to generate some additional cash, Mwila started a tailoring business in her house. It meant that in the evenings, after her regular job, she would sit at her sewing machine, sometimes up to 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, making dresses so that she could earn some more money. Sometimes she wondered how Jack's business was doing, because she saw no money coming in, and she was seeing even less and less of Jack himself. Finally, she decided to move from her four-bedroom house to a much smaller one, which was two-roomed. And she was lucky to find a foreign company that was able to rent her house and pay her in foreign currency, in US dollars. This payment in foreign currency enabled her to buy essential commodities in the duty-free shop to which anybody with foreign currency had access. However, the availability of these US dollars also brought them a problem. Jack started to trade these dollars on the black market. And one day, in a government crackdown on black marketeers, Jack and his foreign business partners were picked up, locked up, and their business was closed by the authorities. That same week that Jack was arrested, Mwila's youngest child, her 3-year-old girl, was taken ill suddenly with a very high fever. She rushed her to the only hospital in town. Unfortunately, the hospital had run out of drugs. Mwila ran around town going to different pharmacies to see if the needed drug could be found. Unfortunately, most of those pharmacies had not been able to import any drugs for quite a long time. Later that night, Mwila's little girl died in her arms. How much of these women's circumstances are due to structural adjustment programs or to government inefficiency, government mismanagement, male irresponsibilities, or other factors, I cannot tell you for sure. However, it is clear that these women's wars and daily struggles are deeply embedded in the economic crisis that the African family is facing. And the structural adjustment programs that are in place today have so far not done anything to resolve this economic crisis. In fact, in the cases that have been cited above, certain structural adjustment measures have led to increased poverty, reduced health and educational services, unemployment, higher cost of living, leading to reduced food intake, failed dreams, increased burdens on women, exhaustion, and most sadly, the breaking up of the African family. A significant factor, too, to take note of is that in the implementation of these policies, the ones bearing the brunt of their consequences do not understand what is going on. Most African women, whether rural or urban, whether educated or uneducated, still remain in a major way outside of policy and decision making, but are expected to pick up the pieces and to cope in very desperate situations. Please don't misunderstand me. Restructuring and adjustment may be needed, but we certainly need it in a different form. In Africa, the end beneficiaries of development are the African people, and in particular, the African producers. And those producers in Africa are mainly the women. Thank you very much. Elizabeth Luanga Okwenji, Africa Region Director of Oxfam America, speaking on the topic, The Impact of Structural Adjustment on Women. The hour-and-a-half panel included lively audience discussion. Respondent Atherton Martin of Jamaica said he thought people working at the World Bank and IMF should not be let off the hook, that they were making decisions that caused other people's children to starve, while they would never let their own children go without food for one day. Geeta Sen, an economist from India, followed up that thought.
About letting people off the hook. I think we've let them off the hook in two ways, not just, you know, saying you're accountable, but actually of buying the whole story about structural adjustment. We often go along with the thing that, yes, it's necessary and maybe, you know, but can't we do it better? And in some ways, that was the whole UNICEF line. Do it with a human face. Do it so that people don't suffer so much. But the real problem is that it's a fake, and it's a fake in two senses. It's a fake because of the fact that it doesn't really solve the problems that it's supposed to be solving. Debt often gets worse. The budget deficits don't improve. I mean, we can list a whole bunch of things. But it's a fake in a second way as well, which is that I don't think it was ever intended to resolve any of those problems at all. Because I think what's being done with structural adjustment at an international level is the same thing that Reaganism tried to do at a domestic level in the US, which is to break the back of a whole social network and the social safety net so that the powers of production in the productive system could figure out a way of converting the system towards their benefit much better, towards greater profits to resolve their crisis. And I think what we are seeing at an international level is identically that. They're trying exactly to break the back of expenditures which make it possible for people to stand against that system and that type of growth that Nolene was talking about. And that's what they're trying to do with it. And so the story about, you know, debt and fiscal irresponsibility and so on, the reason we've been defensive about that is because so many third world governments have been so rotten for so long. I mean, they're bad. But look, I mean, the fiscal irresponsibility, corruption and what have you of third world governments pale into insignificance against the military expenditures and the colossal wastes that take place in the West. But not a word about that will you ever hear. That's beyond the pale, right? Untouchable. We can't do anything about that. But we will structurally adjust the third world to hell so that we can, you know, redefine the terms on which world accumulation can go on. That's really what seems to me anyway going on.
Geeta Sen, an economist from India. Laurie Timmerman, a women in development specialist from the U.S. Agency for International Development, asked about a new World Bank program targeted at the economic victims of structural adjustment. She was answered by Elaine Zuckerman, moderator of the panel.
Because I spent the last 8.5 years at the World Bank, the Social Dimensions of Adjustment project in Africa has two major features. One of them is to collect household data in order to analyze over a period of time the impact on all different income groups of policy reforms, including adjustment policies. And in response to tremendous criticism from the international community that it was just another research activity, it's begun to put together compensatory programs, which are packages of multi-sectoral programs in health, education, nutrition, employment, and so on, supposedly targeted to poor people. It is very much a band-aid program, and there's no way that there will be a long-term effect on the poor. Because they're multi-sectoral, they share the same experience as in the 1970s and 80s of these integrated rural development projects that were very popular, of having so many different agencies and ministries involved in any particular program that they're extremely difficult to get off the ground. So implementation difficulties are a major problem, and also the fact that they're of a short-term nature.
Other participants brought up the question of whether governments could just say no to structural adjustment. Elizabeth Okwenji and Peggy Antrobus respond.
I was in Zambia in 1987 when Zambia went away from structural adjustment. I remember we were bombarded through the media with words of congratulations to the government of President Kaunda on having taken that step. the chairman of the OAU and several other African heads of state send their words of congratulations. Of course, Zambia did pay the price. Western agencies stopped giving funds to Zambia. Sometime later, without any announcement, we did discover that actually Zambia did go back to the measures that the World Bank and the IMF were insisting on.
We're talking here of a particular model of development, a particular system, a particular structure, which is based on the exploitation of people. And what happens when governments say no is what happened in Grenada, is what's happening in Nicaragua, is what's happening in El Salvador.
This discussion on the impact of structural adjustment on women took place at a conference of the Association for Women in Development in Washington, D.C., October 1989. While the U.S. has been promoting structural adjustment programs for debtor countries, it has also changed its own economic status. According to Lee Iacocca, 10 years ago the U.S. was the largest creditor nation in the world. Today, it is the largest debtor nation. At a lecture on the economic future, Wings asked economist Alice Rivlin of the Brookings Institution if she thought the U.S. might be forced to take its own medicine.
The question was, other countries that have been debtors in the same sense that we are have been forced to take very strong structural measures to reduce their federal deficits, for example, by cutting expenditures drastically, often including education and welfare and other kinds of things. Is anybody in a position to say to us we have to do that? Basically not, and it's been part of our problem. I remember talking to the finance minister of New Zealand after they had had a radical restructuring, which actually they weren't forced into by the IMF, but they were forced into by their own economic situation. And I said, how in the world did you have the political courage to do this? And he said, we didn't have any choice. We're not the United States. We can't go out and borrow limitlessly on the world market. We're forced into these kinds of things. And it is our problem that basically we've had unlimited blank check from the world and nobody's been in a position to say to us we have to do hard things. I believe we do have to do hard things, but that they should not involve cutting back on education, for instance. We can do education better, but if we're going to have a more productive economy in the future, we can't be penalizing our education system. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean spending a lot more money on it, but I don't think it means spending less either. And I think we've got to find a way of working ourselves out of our structural deficit problem without penalizing ourselves by reducing our public investments.
Economist Alice Rivlin of the Brookings Institution. The talks in this documentary were recorded between 1989 and 1991. Structural adjustment measures are still enforced today. A 2024 blog post by the International Monetary Fund claims that curbs inflation. It notes governments tend to increase public spending during an election year. For more about Wings Weekly programs and archives, email wings@wings.org. Wings thanks all our supporters, including your local community radio stations, Suzette Cullen and Genevieve Vaughn, whose events can be found at maternalgifteconomymovement.org. Our original sound logo was created by Maggie Payne. I'm Wings series producer Frieda Worden. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.